Welcome to the Transforming Aging Summit, where top conscious aging experts are bringing you inspiration and guidance for living a more meaningful, joyful, and purpose-filled life. Share this powerful event with your friends and family, and join in our conversation on Facebook at The Shift Network. And now your host, Ron Pevney, founder and director of Center for Conscious Eldering.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I'm delighted to introduce our special guest, Ellen Moyer. And the theme of this session with Ellen is Elders Creating a Sustainable World. Dr. Ellen Moyer is an environmental consultant and a registered professional engineer with a bachelor's degree in anthropology, a master's in environmental engineering, and a PhD in civil engineering. Ellen's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and is a frequent presenter of environmental seminars. In her third book, Our Earth, Our Species, Ourselves, How to Thrive While Creating a Sustainable World, came out this past December, and it quickly became Amazon's hot new release in green business, nature conservation, and environmentalism. So, Ellen, a while back, I read your Huffington Post article on the critical role that elders can play in helping to assure that our descendants have a healthy, livable world in which to grow and thrive. And I found your writing very important and illuminating at that time. And since then, you've written an excellent book that I think certainly deserves the recognition it's receiving. And now I'm so glad that we have the opportunity in this summit for you to share your important perspectives and your hopeful message with listeners around the world through conversation. So thank you and welcome.
Well, thank you, Ron. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Me too. So I'd like to begin by asking you, given that the environment has long been your area of expertise, your passion, how did this end up becoming your life's work, or what appears to be your life's work for sure?
Well, it seemed kind of random at the time as things were unfolding, but when I look back on everything, it has a certain logic to it. And I recall that as early as I can remember, probably 4, 5, 6 years old, I was really struck by the human impact on the natural world. My family grew up in a natural area in the floodplain of a beautiful river. We lived on a road called River Road, and it was teeming with wildlife, just so many birds and, you know, beautiful trees, and you know, it was incredible. But juxtaposed with all that beautiful nature was people dumping refrigerators and stoves and anything they didn't want, they would dump, you know, right beside the river or even in the river. And then people driving down our road, they'd throw trash out the windows, so there was litter all over the place. And it just was a very confusing thing to a young kid. My mother would be teaching us about identifying different birds, and then there would be hunters shooting them out of the sky. So it was kind of hard to reconcile all that, and it just really bothered me from an early age. And when it came time to pick a major in college, you know, fast forward a bunch of years, I decided to study anthropology because I wanted to see if people always are so destructive of the environment or, you know, are there friendlier ways people can live? So it was fun to study people in different times and places. And the good news is that people can live non-destructively, and many or some still do today. So after that, I decided to try to clean up some of the damage. So I went into environmental engineering and ended up working mostly on cleaning up hazardous waste sites, but also trying to prevent future problems by coming up with green solutions. So it kind of all sprang from those early reactions to seeing what humans were doing to the natural world.
Well, when Ellen, I'm wondering how you remain hopeful when we look at what seems to so many people like a really grim state of affairs. And I know the vast majority of climate scientists, not to mention people around the world who live close to the land, are painting a grim picture. And they're telling us that there is still time to avoid the worst of human-caused environmental disasters. But then when we take a look at the political forces and the economic realities that have the power, I think it's really easy for a lot of us to lose hope that we can leave a decent world to our children. So in your new book, you acknowledge this grim reality, but you seem to be optimistic, seem to be bullish in the prospects for getting onto a sustainable path. And so what makes you hopeful in the face of all these grim realities?
Well, there are really a lot of reasons to be hopeful. Basically, a really great fact of life is that nature tends to heal. You know, when we get sick, we tend to heal. When damage is done to the natural world, it tends to heal once people stop making the damage. But we also have an amazing track record of turning things around in the past. For example, many elders who are alive today were the ones who created the environmental movement in the 60s and 70s and demanded clean water, clean air, protected species, and were successful in getting the creation of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and many laws that still help us today, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, legislation or laws about cleaning up hazardous waste sites. So we made a big difference at that time, and we've kind of done some backsliding since then. Mm-hmm. But even going back further, people have faced horrific situations in the past and turned them around with way less in terms of tools than we have now. One example would be Europe during the medieval period when the plague was going around and wiping people out in huge numbers. In London in the 1300s, half the population was wiped out because of bad waste disposal practices. You know, people just threw their waste right in the streets, and that attracted rats with fleas, with the bubonic plague and other infectious organisms. And it was really, really bad. You know, people did not have much in the way of life expectancy. It smelled really bad. It was just absolutely horrific. And people put their foot down. They said, we are not having any more of this. It's going to change. They documented the conditions that were going on, and those documents still exist today. And they pretty much forced the government to change the practices, to take the waste outside of the city gates and do things in a more benign way. And that made a tremendous difference, and London began to flourish and still continues to flourish even today. And that scenario was repeated in France in the 1800s, and then in New York City when there were a lot of immigrants just coming in and living in slums and just horrific conditions. People eventually just had it. and said that enough is enough, this is going to change. And they made it change. And these were people without cell phones and the internet, you know, not much in the way of democracy and rights, and they were able to really turn things around when they got really, really bad. And that's kind of a theme in nature. When things get really bad, that's when big change is possible. You know, when someone has a life-threatening illness and they come back from the brink of death, often they have a new vision and they decide, you know, maybe I'm going to get rid of my current job and do a new vocation or make huge changes. So it's kind of a reality that big change is possible really only when things are really horrific.
Well, you know, when you talk about really horrific, I'm reminded of that story that we've all heard so often, the boiled frog story. You know, the story where a frog's in a pot of water and the temperature in the pot has changed very slowly and imperceptibly, and so the frog just adapts and adapts until all of a sudden it dies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it seems to me that such adaptability is a blessing and a curse. And so we live at a time when sure, you could look at bigger storms and things like that and say, you know, this is obvious that the climate is changing in a way that will impact us all. But yet you look at the surveys that I've seen and climate change, or even look at the major themes in the last election, and in the mind of the populace, climate change ranks way down because things aren't that really bad yet. And so I guess my question to you is, do you have any hope, and how can we hold on to hope that we can muster up the energy to affect change before we reach some kind of a tipping point and things are really bad and it's too late to do anything at that point?
Yeah, and it is unfortunate, really, that the people in our country and the developed countries who are the most culpable for this situation are feeling the least impacts. And then people who had nothing to do with the problem are feeling the most impacts, you know.
Yeah.
So that does make it tough. But we do have consciousness, and that helps, and that's different, as far as we know, from the frog in the boiling water, or the slowly warming water. So we can do things in a smarter way. And, you know, we have so many things going for us. And I want to remind people of these things because we often forget all the good stuff. You know, it's a built-in evolutionary trait we have to be always worried about, you know, what could happen, what the threats are to us. And that's natural because people who worried a lot had fewer accidents and left more surviving offspring, and so there was a tendency to have that in our genes, whereas people who are, you know, going around saying, don't worry, be happy, you know, they didn't survive as well. So we tend to have this built-in pessimism. But we need to remember that we have really an incredible record of evolutionary success. We are here after all these years, and 99% of species who have ever lived are gone. So by definition, just because we're here, we are successful and winners.
Mm-hmm.
We're also, because of all this evolution, we are hardwired to strive and to care and cooperate and also live with a deep affiliation for nature. You know, we also have just thousands upon thousands of years of experience living sustainably compared with just a few years of living unsustainably. So because we have been able to live sustainably in the past, it's a good prospect for being able to live sustainably in the future. And, you know, our lives are just so much bigger than before. They're much longer and also richer in opportunities and information. And we also have the opportunity to get smarter with that extra time and experience. And we have, you know, we live in a democracy where we have rights and we have the authority to change the government. We have all this incredible technology, the media, internet, phones. We have intellectual freedom. And we also have experienced elders who know how to create massive change from having done it before. So we have an amazing set of assets to draw on. Plus, with our consciousness, we can choose to be hopeful. You know, we create our own story, and our story creates our lives. So if we choose to have the story that we can succeed, we can turn things around, well, that makes us more confident, and feeling more confident, we'll try harder, and trying harder, we'll be more likely to succeed. You know, Henry Ford really was right when he said, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you are right. So we're creating it. It's all made up. So we might as well go with the option that's hopeful, it's more enjoyable, it's more empowering. And, you know, people have just done incredible things. It wasn't too long ago that many people who are alive today were the ones who rose to John F. Kennedy's challenge. Let's put a man on the moon by the end of the decade, even though we have no idea how we're going to do it. And did it. You know, you put the resources to it and you have the can-do attitude, and, you know, we can do amazing things. So I don't think it's over yet. We've really, I think, lost our confidence, you know. I don't know what has happened to our can-do attitude, but now people just think, oh, we can't do it. You know, it's too big for us. And the problems are large. Climate change just seems so hard to tackle. But if you really look at some potential solutions that would help significantly, they're really not all that hard. So we've kind of talked ourselves into a gloom and doom mindset, which is not necessarily warranted.
I have to add one thing.
The situation is really dire. Okay, so I'm not saying it's not dire. It's extremely dire. But I think we can, I'm confident we can turn things around, partly because we love other people and we love nature and, you know, we don't want to see it destroyed.
Yeah, and especially as elders and elders in the making, if we are at all conscious, we are very aware of the importance of what we leave to our descendants. We're the caretakers. We're the ones who are going to give them a world to live in. And that is a very powerful motivation, I think.
I do too, yeah. And also, you know, people alive today, we've all benefited from this big petroleum party. You know, young, old, you know, we've all gotten a lot of benefits. But people who are maybe in older generations maybe feel like they had more responsibility for putting all those greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And, you know, not to be blaming, but people do care about their kids, their grandkids, and other generations coming along and realize that, you know, what happened on their watch is a big part of the problem. So I think a lot of people really want to help more.
Well, I'm seeing more and more of that. Let's talk about the role of elders, Ellen. You mentioned that role earlier. You know, it seems obvious, I think, that people of all ages are going to need to use their gifts and take stands for a sustainable world. And I'm wondering, is there a particular special role that elders are uniquely equipped to play in these critical times?
I think definitely. And I first became interested in this topic of elders and creating a sustainable world, actually really from your first Transforming Aging Summit. You had on a couple of guests who talked about working on climate change, and it was a real eye-opener because I thought, wow, this could be so powerful because elders have a lot that they bring to the table. Now, you can't really generalize too much about such a large group of people, but some general trends are that elders often have a longer view just because they've been around for longer. So elders have noticed more changes in their lifetimes. For example, in the case of climate change, they might notice that over 70, 80 years, I'm not seeing as much snow in the wintertime as I did when I was young. And younger people are not going to be able to notice something like that.
Yeah.
But also as part of this longer view, they've seen huge upheavals that we've been through, big historical cataclysms like World War II, and seen, you know, what can be done and how we can weather these big storms and come out okay on the other side. So that's a really important awareness that our society needs to have, and only elders can know these things on a more historical time scale. But, you know, elders constitute a large and growing portion of the population, so just by sheer numbers, elders are a big deal. 1 in 7 Americans is 65 years old or older, and every day, just in the U.S. alone, 10,000 people turn 65. So that's a huge flood of people reaching retirement age who have time to help out with things. They're not preoccupied with their careers and not worried about losing a job or something like that. They are a huge untapped resource. They also have...
I've got a long list here.
Elders have a lot of clout. You know, they have a lot of wealth. And they also vote more in general than younger generations. So their voices are heard more. They are a force to be reckoned with because of their citizen participation. And they also have a certain credibility. Retired people who have several decades left of life, you know, if they're lobbying for a sustainable world, they're not doing it for themselves. They're doing it for other people, for younger people. And so they have a lot of credibility when they're talking with government officials or whoever. And they can also take bolder action. You know, they're not worried about that job. Feel like they want to do something, leave a legacy, and have a sense of urgency to act. So they're going to procrastinate less because they have less time to get it done in. And they want a renewed sense of purpose and vitality and contribution, so they can really get a lot out of helping out with these issues. So that's my list.
Well, that's an incredibly meaningful list, I think. And, you know, when I think about what elders can do, I'm thinking of two possibilities. These aren't the only ones, but there are a couple. And one is elders joining together with other elders as a block. And I'm thinking, for instance, of a project that I know you're familiar with called Elders Climate Action, which is an outgrowth of the Conscious Elders Network. And those are elders, you know, going to Washington, D.C. and other capitals together and as elders, visiting with Congress people and trying to perform an educational function. And then the other possibility that occurs to me that I know is very meaningful to you is elders joining with youngers in partnerships to work together, the generations working together for sustainability. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about each of those possibilities and your perspectives on both of those ways that elders can get engaged.
Yeah. Okay, so first, elders working with elders. I heard someone say that someone was asking, you know, what can one person do about all this? And the answer was, stop being one person. Join up with other people. There is real power in numbers. And in doing research for one of those Huffington Post articles I wrote, I looked around for groups that were working on the specific problem of climate change. And I found like 24 elders groups around the world who are working on that one issue. And definitely gathering together does give everyone more clout. It's synergistic. And people also get inspired and motivated and have more fun when they get together and work on things. So
yeah.
My impression from looking into the elders groups that exist today were that they were very vital and getting things done and energized, but the numbers were kind of small. And it occurred to me, wow, you know, if these groups could become a lot bigger by 10 times as many people, 100 times as many people, they could change the world. They could insist that we get onto a sustainable path, and it would be incredibly powerful. I'm even more intrigued, though, with the idea of elders and youngers working together, especially on these intractable, seemingly, problems like climate change. Climate change is going to be solved over a long time frame that involves multiple generations. I don't think that it's going to be fixed in 10 or 20 years. So it's going to be a long-term effort, and we're going to need people to stay on the job over a long period of time. So that is going to require multiple generations working on it. And sustainability, by its very definition, involves multiple generations. Sustainability is just a way of life that can continue into the future without using up resources or ruining resources. So it means that we do things in a way that works for people alive today, but also for people and other species who will be alive in the future. So it's almost a given that we need multiple generations working together. But a really powerful thing is that elders and youngers bring different gifts to the table. And when you combine their gifts together, you get something really powerful. I gave you my list of elders' gifts a few minutes ago. What youngers bring to the table is energy, and you know they can provide boots on the ground, doing more legwork and going to more protests and marches and things like that. They bring idealism and an eagerness to learn and grow. And a very important thing that they bring is proficiency with social media and the internet. I mean, they can really get things done and get the word out to a lot of people. And Younger's teaching these skills to elders can greatly improve their capacity to make big change. So everybody benefits from a collaboration like this, too, and it helps to heal the age divisions in our society. We used to live together much more with different generations being in daily interaction with each other, and that has changed. Now elders are often living away from the rest of the family, and it's another social division in our highly divided society. And by working together, there can be much more understanding and appreciation among the generations for each other. And youngers can learn a lot from elders, especially about nature. You know, elders spend a lot more time outside growing up and have a greater knowledge of nature and a greater appreciation of nature in general. And youngers can also learn how to do things like write an effective letter to a government official. And they can also benefit from encouragement and support. You know, youngers are now suing the federal government for failing to protect the climate. And these are very courageous children doing this. And I'm sure it helps them a lot to get a lot of support from people who are older than them. And then the elders, in turn, they also get a sense of purpose and contribution and belonging, and they're often inspired by the commitment and the curiosity of the younger people, and they also get to learn about social media and the internet. So it turns out to be a really beneficial collaboration. And there's one organization in, well, two organizations working together in Norway that especially struck me in this regard as I was researching what people were up to. There's a group called Norwegian Grandparents Climate Campaign. And they partner with this environmental organization for Norwegian children called the Eco Agents. And they get together and do all kinds of stuff together. They write letters jointly to government officials. They jointly speak to parliament. You know, they get together and they demonstrate in front of the parliament building. They meet in schools. They go to rallies and marches. They educate the public. They together produce this four-page pamphlet that they distributed to all the members of parliament and to school students and public libraries across Norway. And for the Paris talks in December 2005, they took a train together to Paris and did things together there for climate action. And they get a lot of attention. People are very interested to see a lot of old folks and young kids working together. You know, what's up with that? And they people seeing it realize the universality of the issue, how it affects everyone, and that people of all ages care about it. So it's really quite powerful in for the participants and for people observing people protesting or writing letters, et cetera.
Well, I think that's such a beautiful, beautiful model, that Norwegian model you're talking about. And I'm wondering, do you know of any such efforts happening in the United States or Canada? That maybe are trying to build on that Norwegian model?
I didn't run into anything that comprehensive. I do recall an organization called No Planeta B, and I believe they're in the United States and Peru, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they get together, they combine together school kids, their parents, and the schools. And they figure out actions they're going to take to help the climate, and they sign commitments to say, I'm going to do this, 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 and this.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of coordinate together to get things done, and they go to conferences and things together. So there are some efforts, and in the latest Elders Climate Action newsletter, email newsletter, they included a story about our Children's Trust and talking about how the children were suing the government for not protecting the climate. So there's at least awareness, but I would love to see more coordination like they're doing in Norway. And maybe it's happening and I just don't know about it, but I'm not aware of anything that comprehensive.
Well, I'm so glad that you've shared that possibility with us, and I'm thinking in the same way that when you listened to the first Transforming Aging Summit and that inspired you to, you know, a major thrust of your work, maybe somebody who's listening to this summit right now is inspired by what you just shared and is willing to take the lead in their community and try to bring elders and youngers together in the way you've been talking about. So thank you for sharing that. A couple other questions in the we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I think I've got time for a couple other questions, Ellen. One is, you know, many older adults just don't feel they have the energy or the interest anymore to engage in active protests against the forces of environmental degradation, you know, like going to marches and doing things like that. And can you tell us some practical, effective, and enjoyable actions that elders can take to make a difference, short of going and manning the barricades and marching?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Meeting with government officials is so important, and elders can do a really good job with that. You had mentioned Elders Climate Action members meeting with U.S. representatives and government agencies to push for good legislation. That's an incredibly helpful thing. But even just writing letters, letter writing campaigns can be incredibly helpful, and you don't need to go anywhere to do that. Another thing people can do is help divest from fossil fuels. So many elders might have gone to college and be part of or in contact with an alumni association from the college they went to. Well, they can work with those people to get those institutions to sell their stocks that involve fossil fuels or other unsustainable lines of business. They can also help with environmental education, just spreading the word. You had mentioned before that a lot of people are not very fired up about climate change, and part of it's denial and just being distracted by other pressing problems, but there's also been a disinformation campaign to try to actively downplay the significance of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So elders can organize workshops, conferences, lectures, or film festivals. They can also work with retirement communities to find ways to reduce the environmental footprint of retirement communities. So there is a lot that people can do. I should probably not admit that I have never been to a march. And I feel like I've done a lot for the environment. So you don't really have to get out in the street to make an impact. I have a one-page sheet here that Elders Climate Action, the Massachusetts chapter, put together. And it's called, What Can One Person Do About Climate Change? And I don't mean to imply that sustainability is only climate change. You know, there are other aspects.
Yes.
I think what they suggest here for climate change is applicable to anything. So they have seven things you can do. One is to stay informed. Another is to talk to others. The third is to reduce your own footprint, your environmental footprint. The fourth is to become a climate voter. So don't vote for people who don't care about the climate. Become engaged. Get together with organizations working on the topic that you're interested in. Align your investments, the divestment issue I mentioned. And then the last one is demonstrate for the environment through protests. But any of those things helps because so many people are not doing anything. So I think people should not be too hard on themselves and expect themselves to completely change their life and do everything that they think they should be doing. But just do a little more than you're doing now. And if a lot of people did a little more, it would make a big difference.
That would be a lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ellen, one more thing. You know, you began our conversation by talking about how humans have, you know, dealt with crisis throughout our evolutionary history. You know, along that line, we often, we read or hear people who say something to the effect that while human ingenuity, fed by the energy of crisis and the lure of profits, will offer solutions to the environmental crises that we can't even imagine now. And so, therefore, we don't need drastic lifestyle changes. We don't need major changes like a rapid shift away from carbon-based energy, for instance, because human ingenuity is going to find technically based solutions that's going to save us.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I've heard this kind of thing a lot. I read this a lot. I know you do too. How do you respond to that kind of an argument?
Yeah, and I've actually heard it called, quote, technological evangelism.
Oh, okay.
where you just know that some miracle is going to happen to save the day, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I guess my response to that is that it's a bit of a gamble to do it that way, and also that I would hope that people would care more about other human lives and the lives of other living things to do more, because the more people do to help, the less damage there will be. So it's not a yes-no thing. It's more like minimizing the damage as much as we can. So I think it's a handy way to look at things, and it's an excuse for procrastination to say, I'm sure that someone will invent something that saves this whole situation. But it's not helpful as it could be.
Yeah, and as you say that, it also occurs to me that even if that were true, that we can come up with those kind of technological fixes, there's also a reality that we human beings need a healthy, mutually respectful relationship with the planet and the environment that we live in. And that's a part of our humanity and part of our emotional and physical and spiritual health. And so I think, to me, that is also critical.
I agree. I completely agree. It's you know, if there's a house on fire and there's kids or pets in the house, you're going to run right in and try to do something or call the fire department or do something. You're not going to say, well, I'm sure someone will call the fire department and someone will take care of this. It's just a really callous reaction, and it doesn't show very much love there to just assume that something's going to take care of it.
Well, Ellen, I want to thank you for a message of hope, for a message of a message that stresses the important role that older adults, that elders can play in helping to create a world that is full of hope and health for ourselves and for the generations that will follow. The work you do is very much appreciated. I wish it well. Thank you so much for being part of this summit and for sharing with us.
Oh, thank you, Ron. And yeah, I would encourage people to get as involved as they want to be. And I think, you know, there's kind of a message to elders these days that, okay, you're done with your contribution. Now just go over there and don't do anything. But elders could do so much here. They could make the difference. I really believe that.
We can indeed. So thanks again, Ellen.
Oh, thank you, Ron.
And thank you all for listening. And if you've been inspired, as I have, by this interview with Ellen Moyer, I encourage you to take some steps, however small, to act on that inspiration sometime soon. I wish you well on your journey of growth.
Thank you for joining us for the Transforming Aging Summit, brought to you by the Shift Network. To add this powerful collection of teachings to your personal library, visit transformingagingsummit.com/upgrade. To learn more about our global community of people awakening to their divine humanity and taking inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. Thank you again for joining us to discover how to make your later years your better years, and for sharing this life-changing information with your friends and family.